welcome to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate the overlooked, ignored, derided, or the just plain hated. Movies, novels, music, comic books, video games, whatever. If everyone hates it, we will find someone who loves it and let them explain why you should too. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston. My guest today is the writer, podcaster, and internet famous Merlin Mann. Merlin, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Anthony. It's great to be back.
And this is a bit of an odd one. We are taking a slight break from the regular format, if you like, because this episode is for February 29th, a day that should not exist. And so here is an episode that should not exist. And when we were planning this, we joked about sort of turning it around, and instead of doing Unjustly Maligned, we'd do Justly Praised, which is, you know, is fair. But the more I thought about it, you know, the more I realized that what we are specifically talking about actually is kind of overlooked, because you know, we're here to talk about REM, and specifically early REM, and the vast majority of their now enormous fan base actually probably isn't that familiar with a lot of their early stuff, because, you know, they really hit it big in the sort of late 80s, early 90s. And a lot of people don't realize that they were on their like sixth or seventh album by the time they released things like Green and Out of Time. So, you know, this is kind of an overlooked period, which is a great shame, I think.
Yeah, I totally agree. I've spent the morning listening to lots of old REM, skipping around through my favorites, reacquainting myself with stuff that I love. And, you know, it's interesting when you see something that's sort of algorithmically driven. Like in this case, I'm looking at the iTunes, Apple Music page, and there's, of course, a lot of best ofs, there's some live stuff. But like you see these, whatever, something like 12 albums, and most of them are more recent. I think for a lot of people, Automatic for the People, to some extent, maybe Losing My Religion. But I think the Automatic for the People album is when REM went from being a popular small band to a really, really massive band.
Well, that was Everybody Hurts, wasn't it? Which was the huge, huge hit.
Let yourself go. As everybody cries, everybody hurts sometimes.
That's right. That's right. And that is a wonderful album that also just happens to collide with the period where I kind of stopped paying much attention to REM. I was, you know how it is. I mean, and I'm actually really looking forward to hearing how you got into REM, because it seems really off brand for you. But for me, I was getting into other stuff at the time and still adoring everything from Chronic Town forward. But I hope it'll be useful to people, but it's also just a nice old man hour to talk about this band that for its time and what it did, it was very special to a lot of us in a way that was very of its time,
right,
and probably kind of difficult to replicate today, you know?
Oh, I think REM would be impossible to replicate today. Not that there aren't necessarily equivalents, but I think the particular stuff they did and the way they did it, I just don't think you could do that today. I think that would actually be impossible. It's interesting that you said you were skipping around, because I have spent today listening to REM as well, of course. But I did it chronologically. I went from Chronic Town right the way through as far as I could go before I ran out of time, if you'll pardon the pun.
That's pretty much what I did. I was a little short on time, so I skipped over a few tracks, but mostly to just, it's funny because in my head canon, I'm thinking about listening to REM on a very, very inexpensive turntable that played everything a half step fast.
And I used to have one of those, yes.
And that's, so I imprinted on these albums and later cassettes at a time when audio fidelity was not high. I didn't have a lot of dough, did not have an expensive stereo. And I have to tell you, it's still astonishing to me to go back and put on even or especially Chronic Town through Reckoning. And they sound exquisite to me.
Oh yeah. 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 The production on those early albums, we'll have to bring this up, I'm sure, later, but the production is actually, you listen to it now on good audio equipment and you realize actually that's quite good.
More going on than you realize. When you're a kid like me, I'm listening for the chords and the lyrics, but there's lots of kind of spooky stuff going on in the background, interesting sound effects. And so, yeah, it's been great. This REM is one of those bands that I still sometimes, I don't find myself listening to like around the house. I listen to podcasts a lot, but when I'm out of town sometimes and I want some comfort food, I'll just put on Reckoning and just listen to it on speakers, and it always buoys me.
interesting that you choose Reckoning as your kind of, you know, out of town album. Huh.
Yeah, that's I think that might be my pound for pound favorite, but that run, that early run, and I cannot tell you how much of this is just where I was in life at the time and what they meant to me personally. I can't vouch for them 100% musically, except to say that the songs and the band, the look, the enigma, it all just hit me at the right time, at an unreplicable time and experience. And I still, in some ways, I'm probably, you know, being nostalgic in a lot of ways, but they were a very special band. This is one of those bands where everybody felt like it was their band.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, tell me about that. Okay. So tell me how you, when you first heard them and how you got into them.
Yeah, sure. It was a funny time for me because, you know, growing up in Florida, not having a lot of dough and being mostly exposed to things like FM radio, I mostly had what came over the transom. By this point, I discovered REM when I was a junior in high school. So 84. It was around the time of Reckoning. And, you know, at that time, I was into a lot of all kinds of pop music. I liked people always say, I liked everything from jazz to classical, but I genuinely, I love
Mozart to Motorhead is how I always put it.
Oh, God, it's the worst. Shut up. But seriously, I loved Adam and the Ants, Stand and Deliver, as much as I love Teenage Wasteland, as much as I love Number of the Beast, as much as I loved Revolver. Like, they all stood on, like, somewhat equal ground to me. Like, I honestly, this is so crazy, but I mean, you must think this is the silliest, trashiest music, but Stand and Deliver was my favorite song for like,
are you kidding?
Years.
I love Adam and the Ants.
I love that band so much. And then, you know what it was? I was getting, and again, you always have to, I hate to repeat myself with this, but this is back in a time when an album cost $8.69 American. And it was an investment, and you would learn to like it. Like, you would learn to love that album because it was an investment. So I did a lot of reading. This is when I was a junior. I was subscribed to Rolling Stone, which I would read mostly cover to cover every week. I was increasingly seeking out what would become to be called college rock bands, but later be called alternative bands, later called indie bands. But back then, you called it college rock. And in the mid-80s, in this post-punk era, there was so much interesting stuff coming up. So I started learning about a little bit about bands like Husker Du, bands like REM, these bands that would become my all-time favorite bands. And so on a lark one day, I bought a copy of Murmur. I was at this wonderful record store in Tampa called Vinyl Fever. And I think this might be a fever dream, but I swear this happened. The place was about to close. I'm deliberating. I'm going to buy two records this one day. I think I bought The Secret Policeman's Other Ball and Live Record. And I was about to buy Murmur. And I was deliberating. I'd read the reviews. It had been in all, like, you know, Village Voice Album of the Year and all this stuff. I think it was Album of the Year. And I go to the counter to talk to the druid who works behind the counter and get his blessing on this. I said, this REM Murmur album, this is really, really good, right? And he goes, yeah, I feel like keyboard-oriented music.
Still,
it stands as one of the oddest, I think he was messing with me. But he didn't even say, if you don't mind synthesizers. I've never heard the phrase keyboard-oriented music, and it's stuck in my head since 1984. Wow. I brought it home. I put it on the turntable. My girlfriend and my best friend laughed out loud at me. They're like, you just spent $9 on a country album. What did you do?
Oh, wow. Is that sort of... What did those reviews say that you'd read? Because you're right. We all used to read the reviews in music mags and stuff to determine how to spend our precious hard-earned pocket money, chore money, whatever, because it, as you say, it was an investment. So what was it about the reviews that made you think, oh, I'll probably like this?
Well, the obvious and cynical-ish part is that it was very, very well reviewed by places that were cool. That definitely, it wasn't just that I wanted to be cool, but in making that investment, I did want the bona fides of this being something that was at least going to be cool and interesting, even if it wasn't my thing. And also, for every lick of stuff you heard about REM, you're going to hear that phrase, that word again, again, enigma. They were so enigmatic. Mm. It was really, they were, the lyrics were hard to understand. The pictures were always weird and obscured.
They didn't print lyric sheets.
That's right. But even just reading about them, I could tell they were endlessly interesting. They were getting some airplay on like our local like community station in Tampa, but it was really, to be honest, it was a crapshoot. But again, go back to first principles. I had to learn to love it because I had spent $9 on it. And it didn't take that long before it really grew on me. If there were other kids in my school that liked REM, I didn't know about it. This is really the time of what? I mean, around the time we got Phil Collins, Whitney Houston, you know, big, you know, FM radio juggernauts, right, right. Of course, Michael Jackson. And, you know, nothing against any of that, but it, I kind of liked the fact that I had come to love this really weird band that I knew was cool and wasn't that popular with normal kids.
Right, that nobody else in your immediate circle had even barely even heard of.
But, you know, I hope I can be forgiven. I know that sounds silly, but I was, you know, I was 17 years old.
That's important to young kids. No, I get it, yeah.
Yeah, but it was something where it just seemed, it was one of those things also where, like, you know, if you wanted to go and learn about Def Leppard, you could pick up Circus Magazine and have a pretty good idea about everything that's going on with Def Leppard. You get it. You buy the shirt, you got your Pyromania, you're good to go. This band seemed like just this huge tangle of interesting yarn. And like, I could not, even after listening to their albums for 2 years, I was still mulling over what in the hell they were talking about. So it really drew me in.
A huge tangle of interesting yarn is a really good way to describe REM, actually. I like that.
Can I interview you back? Were you into metal mostly at the time?
I was. Okay, so first off, I got into them later than you did. And at the time, I regarded myself as being a real latecomer to REM. When I first got into them, I was like, oh man, I wish I'd got into this band like 5 years ago. You know, I'm a real latecomer. But looking back, I was actually several years ahead of right. the vast majority of the rest of the world. So that was a bit weird. There is no equivalent to college radio in the UK. And that has always informed, you know, a lot of the difference between UK and US music. There is no, we just don't have any equivalent to that.
Really? Well, like the bands you read about in NME, like where would you hear, you would just hear the Smiths on the BBC?
You'd hear them late night on Radio 1 on John Peel's show.
Okay. Oh, basically, of course.
Because we did have John Peel.
Oh my God. So what can you, the influence that guy has had over where we sit today is just staggering.
For Christmas, I just got a biography of his called Good Night and Good Riddance, which was his famous sign off. It's over 600 pages long. It's all about his influence on, you know, UK music culture and just UK culture in general. It's, can't wait to dig into it. Anyway, so that sort of place was the only place you would hear, well, I was going to say early REM, but so here's what happened. I was obsessed with Black Sabbath, Motorhead, Genesis, and the Sisters of Mercy, and various other bands, and I loved Adam and the Ants, and Spandau Ballet. Early Spandau Ballet was a favourite of mine, and, you know, I loved plenty of pop. I loved the Bee Gees, and ABBA, and, you know, Blondie, and, you know, but my obsessions were Motorhead, Genesis, the Sisters of Mercy, those three bands, which is itself an odd spread, I realize.
But like a very pretentious in the not judgmental sense, but like dramatic, like big, big music.
Oh, yeah. I've always loved drama in music. Yeah, I absolutely love dramatic music. Yeah, that's why I love doom metal so much. You know, it's all mm-hmm. about the drama. So that's what I was into. As you say, not at all in the wheelhouse of stuff like REM. The first song I heard was The One I Love.
This one goes out to the one I love. This one goes out to the one I've left behind. A simple prop to occupy my time. This one goes out to
But I literally had no idea who it was or who the band was. It was only in retrospect, you know, looking back, that I realized that that was the first song of theirs I'd heard. You know, when I got the album, I was like, oh, I have heard this one before, years ago. The first one where I was sort of conscious and I thought, oh, this is interesting. Who's this? Was I heard Stand.
Stand in the place where you live. Now face north. Think about direction. Wonder why you haven't now. Stand in the place where you were. Now face west. Think about the place where you live. Wonder why you haven't before. If you are confused, check with the sun.
The Green album,
right.
And that was on, I think, late night Janice Long on Sunday Night Radio 1, possibly. She did a request show, sort of request rock show after the top 40 charts every week, and I think that's where I heard it. Shortly after that, I met, and here's like one of just those weird things, I went to a comic book signing for the launch of Deadline magazine, and I met Philip Bond and Jamie Hewlett. They were, yeah, they were doing stuff in Deadline at the time. Jamie Hewlett was doing Tank Girl, most famously, and Phil Bond was doing Wired World and Cheeky Wee Budgie Boy. And they kept putting references to REM in their comic strips. Like, they'd draw albums in the background. They'd write in the gutters about, like, their favourite REM songs. And I was like, what, who is this band? What's, you know? And Phil basically said, oh, they're great. They're this American rock band. You've got to listen to them. They're amazing. So, not being ever one to sort of want to disappoint my heroes, I went to the local record store and said, I mean, they knew me, you know, and said, have you got any REM? And they pointed me at the racks and said, yes, we have a few. So I bought Green because it had Stand on it. And I was like, okay, I know that. And Chronic Town because it was an old EP. So
oh,
it was cheap.
And it was cheap.
Yeah.
Wow, that's such an interesting way to start.
I know, Stand in Chronic Town, man. And holy cow, the first record I put on when I got home was Chronic Town because I knew that that was, you know, earlier. I didn't know at the time that it was their first, but I knew that it, I could tell by the date that it was earlier. So I put that on first. But interesting thing about Chronic Town, I'm not sure if this is the same in the US as the UK, but in the UK, the sleeve has the sides printed in the wrong order. So I looked for the song titles. I'd pay any attention. I wasn't looking at sort of like side A, side B. I just went, oh, first track, side A, right, bang, put it on. And so the first song that I heard, the one that really kind of sold me almost immediately, was Million.
Wow.
Which, of course, is the first song on side two of Chronic Town. But
that really messes with my head. to think, I mean, this is one of those where the album is so in my bones. I can't imagine listening to one song. You know, it's five songs. You can play that's so interesting.
Yeah. So, and what a song. I mean, what a great song. You've got those muted chords at the start and the Berry's drums are pounding away. And then it all sort of bursts in and Stipe comes in with that crazy urgent vocal. He doesn't take a breath. He just barrels through the whole line.
Something very important is happening, but you can't tell what it's about.
Yeah, I was just blown away. And then it gets to the chorus and you've got that weird chord progression. And there's a suspended fourth at the end of the first line. It was unlike anything I had heard before. And, you know, like I said, I was an obsessive fan of stuff like Genesis and the Sisters of Mercy. So I had heard some weird chord progressions in my time, but this just absolutely blew my mind. And it, I mean, that song is, it's imprinted on me. It's now still one of my favorite songs, but that just sold me. Absolutely sold me. From the moment I heard that song, I was like, I'm in. I'm in. Give me more.
Wow. I think I'm trying to remember the progression for me. It was pretty definitely Murmur and then Reckoning. And then I, at some point in there, I'm trying to remember where I got it. I think somebody had taped me a copy of Chronic Town.
Oh, I wish somebody could have taped me stuff. I was the only person I knew who had even, apart from Philip Bond, you know, who had even heard of this band, who even knew they existed.
I'd heard Gardening at Night and probably Boxcars on community radio, I'm thinking. But all I know is that when I got that, it was jaw-dropping to me. I mean, you know, in retrospect, it's so hard to go look back at something and understand, like, what it meant at the time. But this, nobody sounded like this.
Exactly.
They sounded, there was definitely a huge influence of, like, mid to late 60s, mostly British Invasion sound. There was definitely something to the jangle pop. Yep. You know, I would later, as we'll talk about at some point, the influences of the bands I learned about because of REM. In retrospect, I can go back, oh, yeah, they obviously, like the DBs. They like Big Star. Like, obviously, you see all that now, but nothing sounded like that. Those clean guitars and those indecipherable lyrics. I'm sitting here looking at the lyrics for the songs, and I still don't know what they mean. but it was so propulsive.
Not only that, you read along with the lyrics to the early stuff, and you go, oh, okay, all right, okay. And then, like, you try and listen to it back without the lyric sheet in front of you, and you can't remember it. You're like, no, I still can't work out what he's saying.
Secluded in a marker stone, not only deadlier, but smarter too.
Oh,
all
man.
Along the tomb, all along the ruins, secluded in a marker stone, not only deadlier, but smarter too.
Right. The deadlier, but smarter too. I think I'd got that. But that, then that's the line. That's that line where he just sings the whole thing with no stops, no breaks. There's no lilt in the rhythm. It's just... right the way through without taking a breath. I'd never heard anything like that before.
Yeah, and I mean, in retrospect, after, you know, I went to college and got all colleged up and had a huge interest in verse and poetry, I mean, at that point I could look back and go, oh, this music is, it's willfully arty in some ways.
Oh, sure.
And not in a pretentious way, because it's also extremely catchy and accessible. But there was no attempt to make this easy to understand on the first listen. There was no attempt to go, oh, this is a song about unrequited love. Although some of them were, but not in any kind of an obvious way. And like a poem, like a good poem in some ways, the meaning, if there is any, it emerges more out of mood and inference than any kind of direct signification.
Right.
I mean, you know, obviously this is like, it's ridiculous to try and explain this, but there was something about that where like it evoked such a strong emotional response in me, but it was not a single easy to understand emotional response, except to say something extremely urgent and important is happening, even though I couldn't tell you exactly what it is.
And you have to feel your way to it by listening to the albums over and over again.
Yeah, but exactly. But like, you know, it's funny because there was a similar, I felt like there was a similar template to the first two albums, to Murmur and Reckoning, where they would both kind of like, kind of a, I don't know how to put it, but an ebb and flow, where you'd have a song like Camera. Will she be And like, you can tell Camera is about something very, very sad, but it's difficult to say exactly what it is. I mean, I can right. probably look at the lyrics now. I think it's probably about somebody dying, but like, I'm not entirely sure what's going on, but I can tell it's extremely sad.
I think it is, but I only know that because I seem to remember reading something in their semi-official biography that it was about a friend of theirs who had been a photographer and died, I think.
Okay. All right. I'm looking at it right now. I think that makes sense. Alone in a crowd, a bartered lantern borrowed. If I'm to be your camera, then who will be your face? Ah, what does that mean? It's so great.
Oh, man.
That was the beginning, though, for me. And then I think it's funny, though, that I didn't be by not discovering. So I almost feel like, you know, to me, in a weird way, it's so strange. The curve on Chronic Town is so interesting because it is immensely, immediately catchy from a musical standpoint, even as it is extremely impenetrable lyrically. So in some ways, I'm kind of glad that Murmur, and then, you know, Murmur got me super interested, and I would just sit and learn those songs on guitar with my guitar tuned up half a step. I would learn those songs, but then it was Reckoning that really cemented it for me. But then I'm kind of glad I discovered Chronic Town a little bit later because I appreciated it even more. It was a little bit more garagey, and I was hooked.
Mm. See, I jumped around a lot because I could only get what was available through this record store in town. It was the only record store, you know, in my town that stocked this sort of thing. And they clearly, I could tell after a while that they were getting in stuff that I was buying. So, you know, as I started to buy REM records, more REM records would appear on the racks that I hadn't yet got, you know.
Aha.
But as a result, there was no way that I could buy things in chronological order. I just had to buy whatever they had, including a weird interview picture disc, to, like some promotional thing when they were touring the UK. Very bizarre. So my journey through them has always been kind of a whole, you know, rather than sort of following a progression. Yes, I started with Chronic Town by accident, but it's, you know, from that it was to Green. And then I think the next album that I bought after that was Fables. And then it was, I think, Life's Rich Pageant, and you know, it was really just all over the place.
That's so interesting because it reminds me a little bit, I think, of somebody like Led Zeppelin. Like, if you're there when, through the whole process of, you know, knowing this album's going to come out, hearing and knowing what the next album's going to be, you get super into an album, the next one comes out, you feel super acutely how different or the same it is the previous album. When you're there when it's happening, you have this extremely strong sense of place about, like, you know, you would never confuse, let's say in particular, Led Zeppelin 3 with Led Zeppelin 1. Whereas for somebody who's just sampling that 40 years later, it's like, oh yeah, there's like this, there's some of this, you know, kind of folksy stuff on 3, and there's the, you know, heavier stuff on 4. And you're like, well, no, like there's a giant progression happening between these albums.
Right. But you can't see it from the outside.
Exactly. Cause when you get to sample, there's nothing wrong with that, but if it is your band and you were there with them along the way, it seems so crazy to think of them in any way other than the way you heard them.
Well, and I think that actually, just to take a slight aside, I think that really helped me with some of the later bands that I got into. Most famously, anybody who's listened to me on Thrash It Out, my heavy metal podcast, will know that I'm a huge Paradise Lost fan. And Paradise Lost are famously a band who sound completely different from one album to the next. And, you know, it went, started off as a death metal band, invented gothic metal, and then became sort of an electro synth band for a couple of albums. And it's all over the place. And they lost many fans along the way doing that. But I think, honestly, being able to look at sort of the first 6-7 albums of REM pretty much as a whole and seeing the changes that they'd already gone through by that point and appreciating them as a whole unit, I think allowed me to sort of stick with, not just Paradise Lost, there are other bands as well, but stick with bands that make those changes. Mm-hmm. Because, I don't know, maybe I'm kind of more able to look at it and go, oh, that's okay. They'll change again on the next album. This is clearly what they're doing. And, you know, we'll get, if you don't like this one, we'll just wait a year and you'll get another album with something different. Because that's what REM did. And that was clearly a good way for a band to not stagnate. And that's the other thing that I love about early REM. Yes, Murmur and Reckoning do sound a bit similar in places, but not that similar. And they're the only two that do. Every other album sounds very different. You can hear the differences. You know, you can play, even if you don't know the songs that well, you can play a song off of Pageant and you know that it's from that album. It's certainly not from Fables or from Murmur.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, you could see them really wanting to stretch out a little bit and try different things. And I think it wasn't always an easy process for them. I feel like I've heard, especially with Fables, that was a very, very difficult time for the band. But it's also funny because, I mean, and again, my education on the exact details of REM is a little spotty, but you know, you think about the assuredness of Chronic Town and how Michael Stipe just sounds totally unfettered. If you hear early recordings of them live where they're just kind of a crappy garage band, he's a real performer and he's just going all balls out. supposedly Murmur went pretty well, but with Reckoning, I guess he went into sort of this really introverted thing where he was feeling kind of blocked and didn't want to sing in front of anybody. And
right.
Like, you know, all along
singing
the way,
in the stairwell at the studio and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. You know, you're right. That's an interesting way to look at it. It's, but for anybody who hasn't gone into this stuff, I mean, you know, I think you probably could go in and listen to some of the greatest hit stuff, but you know, maybe at length we can point people to good starting points, but they changed a lot pretty fast. And it was even by 1987, I was already kind of sniffing and being that right. guy where I was like, oh, well, that isn't the REM that I like.
The thing that blows me away, even, and this comes back a little to what we were saying about sort of listening now with good audio equipment, you know, and listening to the fidelity. The thing that blows me away on the early albums, and, you know, REM in general, but certainly on these early albums, is the raw songwriting talent and the taste and restraint that they show. And again, this is something I talk about on other shows quite a lot, but I think taste in songwriting and the ability to not, just because you can play a million notes a minute, to not do that is something that precious few bands actually manage to do. And as I believe Mike Mills, the bassist, was pretty much the only really good musician among them when they started. And you can tell on the early stuff, the bass is way more complex than any other instrument, and he's kind of carrying the songs. But the songs are there, and the arrangements are there, and the dynamics are there, even though they may only be playing four chords.
Right.
And, you know, Pete Buck, bless him, may be just arpeggiating basic open chords on his guitar.
It's an arpeggiated D suspended four.
But it's the way he does it, and he plays the arpeggiated notes, and that's what makes the difference.
I think you're nailing it with that rhythm section. So you think about the great rhythm sections, you think about something like with The Who, where I heard a recent interview with Glyn Johns on Sound Opinions talking about how he had kind of had to go in and say, when he was doing Who's Next, had to say to Entwistle and Moon, guys, you know, you're great, but if you dial this down just a little bit, this song is going to be so much better. So right. If you go back and listen to Won't Get Fooled Again, it's unmistakably that rhythm section, but that little bit of restraint that they added to that is what made that song would have been insufferable if Keith Moon played the way he always played the entire
right,
time.
Right.
It would have been a different song. And what you're describing here, and I may just be rephrasing what you said, but to be somebody like, to be able to do a hi-hat the way that Bill Berry, right?
Yeah.
Is that his name? Bill Berry. But like he is so solid. He is so in the pocket, but he's not doing anything unnecessarily complex. And then what Mike Mills is doing on the bass is weird. His parts are weird,
yeah.
But they don't get in the way. And they drive the song. They provide a lot of the melodic propulsiveness where Buck's, you know, relative, and I'm not slagging off Buck because like he's one of the hugest influences I've ever had in music. But like the fact that he could add these, you know, if he could play these whatever eighth notes like on the beat, it was going to sound great because that rhythm section was just driving that song along. I'm trying to think of a song like Catapult,
right?
The Catapult,
yeah.
I'm thinking of.
Yep. Catapult off Murmur, yeah.
Catapult, Sitting Still, those songs, they just, from the first note, they explode with this propulsiveness. And then they kind of just ride along on this wave. It's,
Well, Catapult benefits again from Bill Berry doing some lovely tom rolls and stuff on the intro, while Mills is like, you know, twanging on the bass, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely, it's, yeah, so.
Talking about overplaying, funnily enough, as we record this, it's not long after Lemmy died, and I was reading an interview with Mickey D, who'd been Motorhead's drummer for about the last nearly 20 years. And Mickey D, if you don't know, he used to be the drummer with Dokken. I think it was
what?
Dokken. And he's like, or if not Dokken, one of those types of bands. And he is an amazing technical drummer. But he was saying how like he always dialed it back because he loved Motorhead so much that he was like, I don't want to take over. You know, I could overplay every single one of these songs and show everybody how great I am, but that's not what Motorhead's about. And that's the kind of restraint that I really, really appreciate in in any kind of artist, and especially in musicians like this.
I totally agree with you. And it's, you know, when you're first, when you're first in your early bands, and, you know, there's the one or two things you know how to do, and you want to do the one or two things you know how to do really loud so nobody will miss it.
Yeah.
And then once you've played in an actual band, like, for example, I improbably got into stage band or jazz band when that same year when I was a junior. And I had so much to learn about playing well with others. I had to learn to turn it down. I had to learn to use that neck pickup more and just learn a little bit more about actual music theory so that my part fit into the song. Yep. And it's in rock and roll, there's, you know, there is so much like, you know, ejaculatory bigness that I think you can lose. Like when you take a band where those people are playing exactly the right part at exactly the right, they could play faster, they could play louder, but they're playing the right part. Yep. And that's, man, that's the ones you really stick with.
The taste in production as well is another thing. Talking about sort of playing well with others and only playing when you need to and sort of dialing it back. I remember reading years ago about how, I can't remember who it was now, but one of their early producers.
Don Dixon and Mitch Easter?
It may have been Don Dixon. Yeah, I can't remember exactly. But basically he was saying, I'd never met a band before where on the mixing desk, everybody's saying, no, there's too much of me in there. Turn me down.
Wow.
he's like, every member was like, no, I'm too loud. Turn me down.
Are you sure you're in a rock band?
Yeah, exactly. Like, wait a second.
As a super fast side note, those two producers have been responsible for so much amazing stuff. I think Mitch, there was that band Sneakers. Are you familiar with them?
No.
I think that was Mitch Easter's band with one of the guys from the DBs. They were in this like, what in retrospect seemed like a super group from, I think, North Carolina. But like Don Dixon, like he had an album called Most of the Girls Like to Dance, But Only Some of the Boys Do. And it's a fantastic album. That same kind of just, what do you call, well, how would you, like just super clear, crisp production. You don't hear, like, for example, especially in the early stuff, this changed a little bit in the middle period. But with REM, you don't notice things like reverb on the album unless they really want you to notice reverb.
Right.
Right. You know what I mean? So
no mistake.
It's again, that helps the immediacy that everything is upfront and at a level where you can hear everything that's going on. But then there will be some crazy thing where they'll just drop in this sudden like chamber reverb that just, it sounds like a huge room for a second and then it stops. And that's, I think, part of Easter and Dixon, supposedly, again, this is from Wikipedia, that they had an interest in stuff like krautrock and Kraftwerk and were interested in experimenting, but not in a way where you go, oh, this is an experiment, like rolling pool, like billiard balls around on a table and recording it. And it doesn't get in the way. It totally fits in with the song. And I like that word you use, taste. The taste level is just exquisite on this stuff. So understated.
That's, is it We Walk, which has got the billiard balls sound effects on it? It's on Murmur, yeah. There's a story that it was actually Bill Berry and Mike Mills were playing billiards in the room underneath, and the sound was bleeding through. I'm not sure if I actually believe that. I think that might be apocryphal, but it's a wonderful story nevertheless.
that is terrific. But there's other songs that you think about, like Stumble. Stumble has that weird opening to it. Teeth. Little harmonics.
Yes. Yeah.
And then like, yeah, just really weird. And then it goes into the song but you know, they do a lot of weird stuff with bridges.
I always wondered with that bit on Stumble, what they're doing is picking the, I don't even know what you'd call it, but the bit of string after the nut, between the nut and the key.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Cause I've done that like many, many years ago for an effect and it's almost the same effect. And now that you mention it, I wonder if that was what they were doing.
It could be. That's Eddie Van Halen does that to much effect. But I think it's probably like maybe a fifth or seventh fret, you know,
like a harmonic, right?
Yeah. Doo, doo, doo. But, yeah, I guess we should talk about the music rather than just describing it. But you can tell I'm just so excited.
A lot of this is about the enthusiasm. Exactly. And that's, you know, that's what it. Okay. So what is your favorite album? Cause I mean, that's the thing. It's, we are this enthusiastic about it. Because we love the music so much. So What's your favorite album?
I'm going to say if I had to pick one for Desert Island, I think I would have to go with Reckoning. Did you never call? Wait. obviously very difficult to pick out, you know, a favorite album from a band that you love. But I feel like beginning to
end, that's the one that you listen to, you know, if you can only listen to one in a day, what's the one that you put on? That's your album, you know?
Yeah, it's like pound for pound. It's like it's REM the way that I, you know, selfishly have loved them the most. It's got a lot of range on it. The first song of theirs that I think I ever went really cuckoo gaga for was probably South Central Rain. And I remember one night coming home from my job as a busboy and watching, seeing the video for South Central Rain, which did not get a lot of play, but I was stunned by it. This gorgeous man playing this song I'd heard a handful of times. I think it's about water. I'm not sure. It's kind of confusing, but I mean, geez, look at these tunes. You got Harbor Coat, Seven Chinese Brothers, South Central Rain, Pretty Persuasion. Oh my gosh. And then Don't Go Back to Rockville, like the ultimate like campfire sing-along song.
Right. Well, and Time After Time.
Oh, it's so gorgeous.
Have you seen the video, by the way, the sort of the long filmic video for the first half of this album?
Yeah, I think that might be REM Succumbs.
That's
which,
it. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, which I bought on VHS, probably like around the time I bought my first VCR.
Yeah.
But again, did that give you lots of revelations about what was up with the band? Nope.
Oh, no. Well, actually, no, for me it did. Because remember, you grew up in Florida. So to you, Georgia was not sort of so strange and exotic. To me, Georgia, I've still never been there. It remains this like very strange and alien, swampy looking place.
Right. So like them wandering around Howard Finster's yard is something where you go, that gives it a sense of place. But you know, it's funny. We also speak, I hate to say, after the recent death of David Bowie. And I think of all the bands that influenced, I mean, maybe there's some Ziggy Stardust in Pete Buck's approach, but I think one of the things that is a little Ziggy-like about REM was just things like their changing appearance, like the way that Stipe always seemed to be in constant flux, and he was never not interesting. He was always weird, and you could tell that he'd be a real smart guy who's probably maybe a little difficult to get along with, but like he just seemed like such a gentle artistic soul who was always going through some kind of a stage.
Yeah, I think it's notable that on the, I think it's the liner notes for Fables, where Mike Mills is listed as like sort of prime conciliator or, you know, something like that. It's like, yeah, he, you know, him and Bill Berry were the ones that kind of allowed the rest of the band to get along.
And there's, you know what, just in passing, there's another thing I've always loved. I think there may be exceptions to this, but I'm pretty sure that that for pretty much every REM song, all four of them get equal credit on it.
Yes, I believe they're all listed as Barry Buck Mills Stipe.
Barry Buck Mills Stipe, yeah. Well, you know, and so, you know, ask Colin Moulding if he could get a deal like that.
Right, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's something else that I always appreciated about, because it was obvious, you could tell, just on the songs, you could tell, well, clearly this song has got more of, you know, a musician in it than another song. And then if you read anything, you know, interviews with them, it was clear that they did sort of, one would go and write a song and then bring it to the others and they'd all meddle around with it and stuff. But it was principally like Pete's song or Mike's song or whatever. But yeah, the fact that they were like, no, we are a band. So we all get the credit for every song. There's a few bands that do that. And I really appreciate that in bands because it really reinforces the sort of, we are a group. We are a collective.
Yeah. 100%. Do you have a particular album that you would pick?
My favorite REM album has always been Fables.
Wow, interesting.
Fables of the Reconstruction. From the moment I heard it, and I think it was like a third or fourth album of theirs that I got. I love the cover, for one thing. I think it has one of the best covers that they ever did. But from the moment that first slightly out of tune atonal guitar comes in on Feeling Gravity's Pull,
stop gravity in the flow.
Yeah, from that moment in, I was like, whoa, this is different. And I was just sucked in. And I love that album for many reasons. One of them is, ties back to what I was saying about, like, you know, Georgia to me was a strange, exotic place. And it's kind of ironic because it's the only album that they ever recorded in England.
Yeah.
But it feels so South. It feels so American to me. The sound of it is swampy. If that makes it feels saturated, you know, when you listen to it,
it's an album that recorded in London that is overtly about the American South. But what's interesting and to me a little bit strange about it is that it does not read as what I would call a country album or a country rock album.
No, definitely
it doesn't sound
not.
Like the Byrds or the Flying Burrito Brothers or Wilco, even for that matter. It's got these inflections and down to like he's more folky, maybe, I guess. I mean, maybe that has something to do with Joe Boyd producing it.
And it feels like there's a longing in there.
Oh, absolutely. Like
the feeling that I get throughout the whole album is we are really homesick. and that just lends such a lovely air of longing and melancholia to the album that I don't know. I mean, and it has its upbeat moments. It's got Driver 8. It's got Auctioneer.
Well, it's got Can't Get There From Here, which
right.
If you take, so some of these songs on here, like Feeling Gravity's Pull, the lead off track is very portentous. It feels like something very important. Maps and Legends, it's kind of this slogging.
I love Maps and Legends so much.
That's a terrific song. But all of the, even Green Grow the Rushes, so many of these are understated. Can't Get There From Here is wacky.
Yeah, it is.
It's a silly
funny,
song.
It's a silly, funny song. Yeah. Green Grow the Rush is my other favorite track on this album. Feeling Gravity's Pull, Maps and Legends, and Green Grow the Rush are my three favorite tracks on this album. But I love them all. I really do love them all. Just, it's, I've often wondered if it's kind of overcompensating. You know how expats move like to another country and then all they do is spend all their time with other expats and build right. this little enclave that reminds them of home. And they end up being more British, American, whatever, than the people back home. Because it's all they have to cling to.
I absolutely know what you mean.
And yeah, I've often wondered if this album was a product of the same sort of thing, like they were missing it so much that they actually made their most American-sounding album while recording in England.
But also, you know, as much as we think of them as having this place in Georgia in general and Athens in particular, I mean, Athens was a pretty hip college town. And, you know, Buck and... was it Mike Mills maybe met at a record store where, you know, Peter Buck was like a total hipster. So, I mean, it wasn't like they were working on tractors, but at the right. same time, there's something very resonant about the folk imagery of the South that maybe is one of the most consistent themes through all of their early work. Even if they're playing a song that sounds a little bit like, you know, Paul Revere and the Raiders, like there's something that does have that kind of melancholic Southern feeling. You know, it's a lot like reading William Faulkner. You know, there's a lot of folks who still have bullet holes in a couch in the attic in the South. They remember.
Well, the first album is like a photograph of just kudzu for
yeah, it's just like a bridge trestle covered with kudzu. Yeah. Kudzu is the worst. I'm just looking here and passing I don't know if it's, I don't want to go on it too far of a tangent, but I was a giant fan of Dead Letter Office when it came out. Because
oh, yeah,
Dead Letter Office,
yeah, yeah.
It had so many of their wonderful like B-sides, plus a CD, your own CD copy of Dead Letter Office at the end of it. But I'm looking here, the stuff they contemporaneous to Fables. How weird is this? Crazy, you know, the cover of that Pylon song. Yeah. Their ridiculous fake heavy metal song, Burning Hell.
Which I've always loved because being a real heavy metaller, that is so not a heavy metal song.
Oh, it's terrible. It's
God like, bless you that you think this is like the closest you'll ever get to heavy metal, you know?
Women got legs, men got pants. Yeah. You got the picnic, I got the ants in hell. But then also Bandwagon, like the Fruity Chord Change song. I've always loved that song. But all from those same, I think from roughly the same time, I guess. I'm not sure. This might be from the Reckoning.
Drunken
era.
King of the Road as well, of course.
Oh, that's so good. I love...
You can hear Mike Mills shouting the chords out to Pete
G!
Buck.
G!
So funny.
But, you know, this is also, I have to say, the thing about Dead Letter Office, you, again, go back to being a kid in Florida in the 80s, and any tips that you could get about what else to listen to were very valuable, especially when you kept hearing these same names come up over and over. So I'd heard about the Velvet Underground. I'd certainly heard things like Sweet Jane on the radio, but it was them covering three Velvet Underground songs that made me go out and seek out Velvet Underground, which again, now later became one of my,
within
a year was one of my favorite bands. It's the proximity to stuff that they were influenced by and the bands that they were associated with became this personal recommendation engine for discovering some of the stuff that I still to this day love. One time I saw Peter Buck with a shirt that said Husker Du Metal Circus on it. And I was like, that's a really cool shirt. And I went and I learned about Husker Du. And I was like, I see, these guys are amazing. That's how it worked back then.
Well, I think that's still how it works. Perhaps less so in this Spotify era. But I've talked about this with regards to the grunge bands as well before, because to their credit, like all of the sort of big grunge bands were very, very quick to point out that they were continuing a tradition that had been started by bands like Led Zeppelin and Black Sabbath. And they were, you know, they were pointing people at, and the Velvets, and they were pointing people at the bands that they had been influenced by. And an awful, my God, I don't know what it was like in the States, because Zeppelin, I know, have always been a big mainstream band in the States, whereas over here, they are kind of regarded as, you know, sort of old, quaint old rockers. But in the 90s, you could not move in student bedrooms for Led Zeppelin posters on the wall. And it was all because of bands like Nirvana and Soundgarden and, you know, Alice in Chains or whoever, Pearl Jam, talking up Led Zeppelin and going on about how great they were.
That's so interesting. Yeah, they've always been, you know, with FM radio being what it is, they were, and Stairway to Heaven being what it is. You know, I still have an annual listening to Stairway to Heaven that I do, which is exactly as often as I want to hear Stairway to Heaven, because I listen to it once a year and I remember what a improbably wonderful and majestic song it is, but I don't need to hear it a second time that year.
Well, and if you've ever spent any amount of time in guitar stores, as I know you have, you know, that Wayne's World joke is not a joke.
Oh no, it's real. It's real.
But yeah, getting into a band because your favorite band was influenced by them is absolutely a thing. And that is, yes, REM. I definitely went out and bought things like Pylon Records and, on the Athens, Georgia Inside Out documentary.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Some of the bands on that I went out and bought records by because they were on that documentary. And I thought, well, if they're in the same film as REM, they must be good.
Oh, this for me, like 10,000 Flowers Bloomed. And just in brief, I mean, it went very quickly. And this also has a lot to do with the, I don't know, I still think the staggering explosion of wonderful, like underground and college rock, starting in the early 80s, but by 1984, 1985, there were so many legitimately amazing bands. You can go back and read that book, This Band Could Be Your Life, for you know what it was like to discover like Husker Du, the Minutemen, the DBs, but then also the bands that were related to REM through people like Mitch Easter and Don Dixon. So that's how I discovered Game Theory. It's how I discovered Green on Red. It's how I discovered Dream Syndicate. It's how I discovered Big Plans for Everybody, or not Big Plans for Everybody. What's the name? Mitch Easter's actual band, Let's Active. Right. You know, so if you like REM, there's a really good chance you're going to like Let's Active. And I actually saw them open for REM one time and they were great.
Well, and REM were also very generous, again, when doing press about talking, not just about bands that had influenced them, but current bands that they liked. Like, you know, I can barely recall an interview with REM where Pete Buck especially didn't name another band and go, they're so much better than us.
Well, and in particular, bands like NRBQ. Like, I had never heard of NRBQ before Pete Buck. I was like, what is that? It's like, what is this? Some kind of funky, like, New Orleans music? But he was, you're right, they were very generous about, or later on, things like getting KRS-One to rap on their album. Like, that sounded unheard of at the time. It was so weird.
It was, but they were so good about that. And the band I was specifically trying to think of from the Athens, Georgia Inside Out documentary was Dreams So Real.
They
weren't in the documentary at all, other than a performance of a song, which they performed in a studio live, but in a studio. And that song, ironically, is not on their first album. But I nevertheless went out and bought their first album, which is called Rough Night in Jericho, and it remains one of my favorite albums from that era. It is every single track on it It's a bit like someone like Murmur or Reckoning, like no filler. Every single track is just amazing.
Great. I will totally listen to this. Well, my recommendation for you in passing is, and this is on Apple Music if you've got it, go check out Most of the Girls Like to Dance, But Only Some of the Boys Like to, by Don Dixon, is one that's really great. And I'm going to add this one, Rough Night in Jericho. That sounds so familiar. It used to be so much harder to like even just dig up. Like there might be an EP you read about in a magazine and it might be out of print by the time that you can find it.
Oh, that
was so hard to keep up.
Yeah. But man, yeah, early REM. And okay, so you lost interest, you said, around, so you liked Out of Time, but you lost interest after that. Was that it?
I think in retrospect, I mean, honestly, it sounds so silly now to talk about this as this period of like really 3 or 4 years, but and again, it's all so located at a time and place. Like I remember, you know, Reckoning was so much a part of like, you know, what, junior, senior year. And then when Life's Rich Pageant came out exactly as I was starting college, that summer, I guess. And then it came out. I remember that was the cassette, that and the album, The Smiths, were just like all I played at that year. I was kind of a little bit late to The Smiths. And then, you know, of course that was the same time like Queen Is Dead came out. And then, you know what it was at that point, I was the REM guy. So, and I played their covers at like coffee houses and stuff like that. They were my band. I was obsessed with REM. So I don't want to say I made myself like their stuff, but like, I don't listen to Orange nowadays. I like Document. I thought at the time Document, I thought was fantastic. I lost some of my propulsive fervor around, what's the one with Shiny Happy People? Is that Orange?
No, that's Out of Time.
Oh, not Shiny Happy People. I'm sorry. What's the one? Stan.
You mean Orange? Oh, Stan. That an Orange Crush is what you're thinking of. The album's Green.
Green. Sorry.
It's all right. But it's an Orange album cover.
Well, there's also, to make things worse, there was a band at the time called Green that put out an album called REM as a joke. Yeah. No, it's REM all the way down. But you know what it was? And then I think the swan song for me was, at the time I had finished college, I'd had this summer where I was living in a garage and I got a job and had to move somewhere and it was leaving this life behind. And that to me, that was Out of Time. Because I remember Out of Time came out. I thought it was really quite good. I thought it was, I don't see a return to form because it was so new and different, but I thought that was one of their most assured albums to date.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Definitely poppier, but like when you'd go to a billiards place, it would be on the jukebox and you could play it. I have a very specific recollection of playing Losing My Religion at this billiards place in 1991.
I worked behind bars at that point. I was working out my student days, you know, working behind bars for cash, and Losing My Religion was the era, of course, sort of when music video, MTV used to play music videos on rotation and other channels started coming up, and Losing My Religion was constantly on video rotation. My abiding memory of one particular pub that I worked at for nearly 2 years is Losing My Religion on constant loop on the video.
But the thing was, that video was amazing. It was great, perfect for the song. And I was excited for REM because they were still arty and they were still weird and they were still moving. And so, you know, it wasn't that like stop, but also, I mean, just again, personal history. I now had moved to a town where this is when I started to learn more about, I mean, obviously I've been listening to Dinosaur, but that's when I got into Sebado. That's when I started getting more into the bands, the like Merge and Matador bands. And I started a band, an indie rock band. So at that point, it wasn't like that they were uncool or something. It's just they weren't for me anymore at that point. I still was happy to see their success, very happy with the success of the Automatic for the People, their downer album. But I kind of moved on.
The downer album. What I loved about Automatic was the last album of theirs that I really liked. After that, my interest dropped off, partly because I was getting into much, much heavier stuff in general. That was when the period when I was really getting into thrash metal and doom metal and, you know, whatever. But what I loved about the progression of those albums, like Document was sort of the last of their rock albums in a way. Like it was the progression that they'd had right the way from Chronic Town. Same basic sound. Yes, they sounded different on every album. The production made them sound different, but it was still, they were playing the same kind of music. And Document was like the ultimate maturation of
But they weren't markedly different in the way that they would be with something like Drive.
Exactly.
I mean, that's a
right.
very different, or even Everybody Hurts. Part of it also,
that's what I was saying. So they got to Document, and Pete Buck is on record as saying that they got bored He was like, I can write Driver 8 in my sleep. I'm fed up of writing those songs. I want to write something else. And so they made Green. And Green, of course, has that almost entirely acoustic second side of the album. And then they make Out of Time, and that's even more acoustic and even quieter and even less rocky. And then they go to Automatic. And Automatic for the People is like, it is the least rock album by a rock band you could ever hear. There's almost no drums on it, it feels like at times, you know. It is so quiet, so almost ambient in places.
Well, almost funereal almost at points. Right. It's a very sad album.
But that's kind of why I liked it. Not just because it was sad, but because it was, they were continuing to like, okay, how far can we push this? How far away from the sort of traditional rock sound that we've built up can we go and still be ourselves? And I thought that was really interesting. And then they completely flipped it on its head with the next album, Monster, and that's kind of why I lost interest.
Yeah, if Monster was the last time I saw them live, and it was great, because it was very conducive to a live show back then. But yeah, but I mean, you know, everybody changes and they move on. But I'm glad all that stuff is there. There's probably something for almost everybody with a smart pop and rock sensibility to find in those albums. And it's an amazing legacy.
Oh, I think so. Absolutely. And yeah, as I say, Document in particular is, I mean, it's kind of weird. I would never say that Document is my favorite album, but I will never, if it's on, I will never switch it off. Because once again, it's like all killer. There's not a single track on that album that isn't worth listening to.
Oh yeah, this was you know what? This is a smart record. They had that weird Wire cover on it. That's one of the ways I learned about Wire, which later became one of my favorite bands, between them and Minutemen. But yeah, no, it got Into the World as We Know It, One I Love. You're right. This is a good one. I should give this another listen.
It really
Finest
is.
Work
yeah.
song, terrific. Yeah.
But that's what. But no, it's not my favorite either. And I think part of that is because it does feel. Jason Snell pointed this out when I did the Genesis episode, and I'd never considered this before, but I think he's right. There's something a bit weird in my brain where I don't like things that are too slick. I almost like records where you can hear the band trying to figure things out and occasionally getting it wrong and occasionally going too far in the wrong direction. But that's actually what I find really interesting and exciting. And that's kind of why, like I say, I will never switch Document off, but it would never be even in my top three, I think, REM albums. And I think part of that is because it's almost too good.
Right, too polished.
Right, right. By this point, they know exactly what they're doing and they can do it so well that there's no flaw on them. It's like that, you know, what's that Japanese thing where...
Wabi-sabi.
That's it, exactly, where they there's no such thing as perfection. And, you know, they will deliberately make flaws in works of art because nothing can be perfect. And that's kind of how I feel about Document. It's lacking flaws. And consequently, just I love it, but not as much as the albums where you can hear them occasionally hit a bum note or where, right, you know, right. the guitar stuff isn't as complex or the drums don't sound quite so clean, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Probably, you know, many of the great rock quotes I've learned have come through Peter Buck. And I don't know if I heard this from him or maybe Paul Westerberg or Lou Reed, but somebody once said all great rock and roll is on the verge of falling apart. And I don't know if that's strictly true, but there should be something where it might go off the rails. Like, you want to be professional, you want to be polished, but like these are more, these songs are a little bit more of statements in some way. Not that that's bad, but I feel like there is an assuredness that there's like, this is the topic that we're talking about and here's what the song is about. And not that that's bad, but I like it when I didn't understand what they were talking about. I enjoyed that.
Or literally didn't even understand what Stipe was saying.
Up to pie on Katie bars of kitchen signs, but not me in? What? I know that's not right, but even the actual lyrics for Sitting Still don't make that much more sense.
Do you know, I genuinely have never read the lyrics to a lot of early REM songs because I don't want to know. I can sing along to the sounds perfectly. I mean, I can do the best REM lip sync you will ever see in your life, but I don't know what the words are. I'm just imitating the sounds.
Well, that's the funny part is this morning I've been going through and going, you know what? I'm finally going to tear away the veil. I'm going to go to lyric sites and try to find the lyrics for some of these songs. And the truth is, like I say, even when you know them, they don't make that much more sense. I think one of the possible exceptions is Harbor Coat. And it's very repetitive. They crowded up to Lennon with the noses worn off. My handshake is worthy. It's all that you've got. Metal shivs on wood pushed through our back. There's a splinter in your eye, and it reads, react. That's actually pretty great.
R-E-A-C-T.
R-E-A-C-T. Oh, man. He's got to have his harbor code. He can't go outside without it.
Oh, man. All right, let's wrap this up. This has been an absolute pleasure, Merlin. Thanks so much for coming on and talking to me and geeking out with me about REM.
Thank you. I think it's been a pleasure, and it's been a real nostalgia trip, but also it's going to make me go back and listen to this stuff again. I hope other people can find and enjoy it too. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I hope so. I really do. On the off chance that people aren't familiar with you, where can they find you?
Oh, you know, I'm Hot Dogs Ladies on Twitter. And you know, that's the, you know, I'm out there, I do podcasts. I would say check out the show I do with John Siracusa called Reconcilable Differences. That's one of my favorite things I do right now, and it makes me very, very happy.
Well, and it's not a million miles away from the conversation we've just had, actually, is it? So, I mean, the difference is that, you know, you're into REM and John is not, but...
Well, you know, the deck, I guess, for the show is, you know, John and Merlin try to figure out how they got this way.
Right.
And I think that's almost every podcast I do, and it's certainly a lot of the podcasts that I really enjoy. Well, it doesn't have to be podcasts. Any kind of talking is... I like two people trying to figure out how they got this way. That will never stop interesting me.
Oh, yeah, same here. I always like to figure out why people love whatever it is that they love. That's why I do this show.
Well, and I would like to thank you for your Thrash It Out show. I haven't heard every single episode, but I inevitably discover something new and wonderful when I listen. What was the one about the symphonic band with that wonderful woman who always smiles?
Within Temptation.
Oh, my God.
I was amazed when you said that suddenly you'd become a fan because of that.
My wife walks in. And I'm watching, they have there's a full live show of theirs on YouTube. And she walks in, this woman, like in a corset, like singing kind of like opera. She walks in, she's like, what are you watching? I was like, you don't want to know, but it's gorgeous.
I'm so sorry, Mrs. Merlin.
Thanks for listening to Unjustly Maligned, and please remember to check out my comics, books, and music. Go to anthonyjohnston.com for information and links to all of my work. You can support the show by rating Unjustly Maligned on iTunes, and if you really like it, please leave a review. It's the best way to spread the word to new listeners. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable and is made in England. You can find information, links, and show notes at ump.fm. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Talking about the early sort of mumbling and stuff, it always makes me laugh a little because it's almost like he's forgotten the words to his own song.
Mm-hmm. And so he just like finds some, you know, little like, something. And even in live songs, it's live versions, he'll change it up.
He changes the words.
Approximate it like phonetically.
Yeah.
Oh, there was such a great quote.
Oh, go on.
No, just a quote from on the page for this lyrics for Sitting Still. Stipe, this is Stipe's remark on the song Sitting Still. An embarrassing collection of vowels I strung together some 400 years ago. Basically nonsense.
Oh, man. No, but there's... I'm trying to think what the song is. I think it's on Murmur. Is it 9-9 or Shaking Through? Damn it, I can't remember. There's one where... That's it. It's, what is it? We could gather, throw our fears.
That's Sitting Still.
Sitting Still, right, okay. And that particular line, the original lyrics are, we could gather through our fear. But a fan, again, probably apocryphal, but he says that a fan told him that he thought he'd been singing, we could gather, throw a fit.
100%. And, that's what I always assumed it was.
And asked him what it meant. And he said, no, that's not what I was singing. But you know, maybe and so he just alternates and sings whichever version he feels like.
I love that. I mean, that so much.
I don't know if that's true, but it's a lovely thought, and it's the sort of thing you could imagine Stipe doing.
You should have seen me in the mid to late 80s, sitting there at a coffee house, covering Shaking Through. And I still
you actually covered REM songs.
Tons. That's how I learned my love of the suspended D chord. You know, between Pete Townsend and REM, it's like, oh God, that's
D suspended fourth, one of my favorite.
It's the best.
So easy.
It is.
You know how when you get, like, everybody gets together at New Year and sings Auld Lang Syne?
Mm-hmm.
And everyone sings the first verse, like, bellows it out really loud. Should old acquaintance be forgot? And then they get to the second verse and everybody's like, hmm. That's what early REM sounds like.
I don't think I knew there was a second verse. So you're saying they do an REM, like, they kind of, like, they murmur up the
exactly.
second verse.
They're all like,
hello.
Maybe you run, maybe you
Hello.
Maybe you rock around the clock, baby.
I'm so embarrassed.
Peter
by
Buck's terrible
fact.
Piano playing.
That's the beauty, though. Even his early guitar stuff is so. It's in my notes here. That's one reason I love it. Is you can feel him learning guitar on every
right.
record.
We are going to talk. Yeah, but save it for the show.
Save it. It's the best. I think it's the best app on Apple TV, which is not saying much, but
right. That's a pretty low bar.
Oh my God. I
accidental.